Accession number 11261, Reel 2.
Pavulovich, Reel 2.
All right. That was a disastrous war. The Germans invaded. The Croats turned against the former state. Pavelić came soon after, a few days after the outbreak of the war. He came back with his ustashes. He started organizing pogroms and persecutions and murders. And people were, I don't know how much you know about it, but people were herded into their churches. Well, this was a terrible, terrible thing that happened, because the Yugoslav army disintegrated mainly because of this destructive and anti-state propaganda and the sentiment amongst the Croatian population. They were led to believe that, the independent Croatia would be a prosperous state, and that they were going to clean Croatian, or so-called independent state of Croatia, of all non-Croatian elements. That meant we had almost 2 million of our Serbian people in Croatia, which had about 5 million plus inhabitants at that time. So you can say one in three was a Serb. And they avowed in aim of their leaders was made by that notorious chap who was repatriated recently, Quaternik. Not Quaternik, what was his name? One that was sent back from Australia. He was the Minister of Interior, Artukovic. Artukovic, that there was so much hullabaloo about him. Now, his and his government's aim was to kill off one third of the Serbs, which was about 700,000, to expel one third, and to convert the remaining third to Roman Catholicism. And they were more or less as good as their word. They carried it pretty well to the letter. Give a few thousand this way or that way. And that was the kind of philosophy which sort of started to be applied rigorously, relentlessly, most cruelly. And I think whatever Hitler did, this could compare quite legitimately with what he did or what Mussolini did. Now, I don't know whether you saw that program about the Italian atrocities. Did you see that? In Abyssinia, in Greece, in Yugoslavia. Well, again, and peculiarly enough, no Italian was prosecuted as a war criminal. The only Italian general who was condemned and shot was apparently an anti-fascist. You heard that? All others escaped, including the Badoglio and Graziani, and they had great influence with the Western politicians after the war. But the Italian government, they again very cleverly staged so-called trials, where they were mock trials. I mean, they were not trials really; they were just nominally condemned, given nominal sentences, and of course after that no one could touch them. They said, we have already dealt with them. Anyway, you remember that is a documentary, and I think that proved very explicitly the tragedy of the situation. Anyway, in Croatia people were persecuted, killed without trial. They would be rounded up, the whole villages would be rounded up, either massacred there, they would be taken, thrown down deep chasms and caves, and there were not hundreds but thousands of them heaped on top of each other. One or two people managed to escape even from such horrors, but There were even cases where the whole congregation would be forced into the church. The church would be locked, and then the killers would come in and just start butchering people, children, women, everybody. They would be walking in blood and then set the church on to fire. That happened in Glina, that happened in various other places. It's all documented, and it's, you know, there's some terrible atrocities. The Serbian population was unprotected then. And you see, this is in a way something that helped the rise of the partisan movement, because there was no one that could protect them. The Germans were not going to protect them. The Italians were not, seeing, you know, the kind of massacres and, you know, atrocities they carried out themselves. Although one or two of them people objected to this, even one or two of these generals, you know, raised voices of criticism, but nothing. Well, in some cases, yeah, I must say, in all honesty, they even protected, and this is to their credit, some of the Serbian population against the Ustashes, although Ustashes were their allies. The Serbs were not. I mean, they were simply, you know, enemies that to get rid of, because, as you know, Italy wanted to have the Dalmatian coast and the whole of the Adriatic, and of course the Serbs would be against it, and the Croatians were. But the Croatians here were prepared to compromise and to work hand in glove with the Italians. They even were supposed to have an Italian king. I can't remember his name, but anyway, he never came. The Duke of Spoleto, that's right, the Duke of Spoleto was to be the Croatian king, although he never came to Croatia, never took up his or occupied his throne. That kind of situation was bedeviled by this almost paranoid hatred of the Serbs, everything non-Croatian, and of course the Germans and the Italians didn't have much sympathy for us either. I mean, Hitler was furious, and as I said before, he was determined to teach the Serbs.
You also indicated that perhaps this was a reason why the partisans, is that came
yeah.
to
I can't
more
come
power.
Into it now. Yes. Now you see when the country was occupied. This was the independent Croatian state, and as you can see, that is a huge area that was given. In fact, the Croatia came right up to Belgrade here, because Zemun is here, Belgrade was there, and so it was all given to Croatia. Germany was occupying, there was Slovenia, which was under the direct rule, or some of it was left under the Italians, some of it was under the Germans. This part here was given to Bulgaria, so that was part of Yugoslavia, part of Serbia and Macedonia, given to Bulgaria. Hungary took that chunk here in Vojvodina, Banat and Baranja and Bačka. So that was annexed by them, and they also carried terrible atrocities there and killed hundreds of thousands of people. Montenegro here was occupied by the Italians, and the Italians were also occupying this part of sort of Macedonia, well, sort of whole old Serbia as we knew it. The Albanians were there, again, their allies, and they were working with the Italians. They formed their sort of partisan, sort of, you know, fascist brigade, this called the Skanderbeg Division, which proved to be terribly cruel and vicious as anything that the German and SS units have been doing. They're equal. So you can see there was a very little bit here that was left of Serbia. Montenegro. So this was all that was left of Serbia, which was under direct German occupation. they had their own commandant, and everything was done by them, and all orders came from them. And then when the... Now again, you see, it's a very long story, it's a very complicated story. When the war ended, or, and the army disintegrated, General Mikhailovich, he was then colonel, well, lieutenant, no, not lieutenant, what is it, the full colonel. He was, you know, the staff officer. He did not want to surrender, and so with the... A group of officers, they found a resort in one of the mountains here, Ravna Gora, and they started organizing, not doing any doing anything at the time. I mean, after all, there was nothing you could do anyway. The army was completely collapsed. The Germans had taken everybody, you know, who was, you know, within their reach, and sent them to Germany. As prisoners of war, a number of people have been killed. Some people have fled, but again, where was to flee? To Hungary, to Italy, to Bulgaria. I got, you know, a few things to tell you about that, because I was there where the Bulgarians came. But I have experienced that particular section better than any of these others. I can speak about Croatia, what happened in Banat and Vojvodina, only on what evidence I have read about or heard from others. But from the Bulgarian area, in fact, it wasn't here. You see, my home was somewhere here by the frontier. And, of course, the later on that was given to the Bulgarians to control and to well, more or less do what they liked. Now, I was telling you that Mikhailovich then, with a group of officers, I don't know how many, several hundred, was it less than that, I'm not sure, I wasn't there, he started, you know, sort of developing this new nationalist organization, the nationalist movement, hoping that one day, you know, when the Allies came nearer, it would be possible then to start fighting against the Germans, against the Italians, against all these occupiers.
This would have been the volunteer force, would it? The Chetniks?
This was all on that basis. Now, this happened straight after the war. I can't give you, you know, what particular date, but it was there, as the army was, but it was done before the armistice was concluded. Well, not armistice, really, because it was a document of surrender. I mean, it was complete capitulation. The Germans wouldn't entertain any discussions about it. So Serbia was left now to pay the reparation to Germany and her allies for the war incurred by the whole of the country. So all that was pushed onto Serbian shoulders. So the Serbian people had now to be enslaved themselves, slaves themselves, had to pay so much. And you can imagine, everything that was worth anything was plundered, taken. The Germans did what they liked, and no one could stop them. Mikhailovich wasn't active yet. Neither were communists or partisans. And this is where people very often make a mistake. They say, now, Tito started fight against the Germans. No, Tito did not start fight against the Germans, because Tito was, at the time, still very much on the ground, organizing himself, organizing his troops. But because at that time Germany and Russia were allies, there was no idea, or not the slightest idea, that they would be ever fighting the Germans. They were acting as their friends. They infiltrated themselves into all sorts of positions with the Germans, as couriers, as interpreters, as clerks, any possible job where, you know, Germans needed local population, they would be amongst the first. Now, that gave them a chance now, being with the Germans, working for the Germans, at the same time to denounce all their ideological enemies, people who they knew from before the war, who were anti-communists or not communists or just not in favor of their ideas or skeptical. So they denounced all sorts of people, intellectuals, leaders, priests, teachers, ordinary people, peasants, if there were more prominent ones. And many of these were in prison, taken as hostages, taken to a place, to a big camp, Banjica, near Belgrade, and various other places. But I think Banjica was the most notorious one and the biggest, where, again, thousands of people perished. Now, by doing this, they managed to get rid of many of their old enemies, settled many scores, still keeping quiet, still not, at the same time, collecting weapons, organizing themselves. Now, why? I don't know. They were planning to have a coup one day to take over, just as Mikhailovich was doing. You see, he said, well, right, we'll be ready, and then, you know, for any eventuality. So the same happened with them. Now, when, on the 22nd of June, Germany attacked Russia, then the SOS came from Moscow, from Stalin, to the Communist Party, to fight and help Mother Russia. There was no question of even then fighting for Yugoslavia, for the liberation of Yugoslavia. Now, come and, you know, we need your help now. So this was the day when, obviously, the communists, I mean, they couldn't believe it, that, you know, now their allies until yesterday are becoming their enemies and attacking their, you know, the holy of holies of communism, of Marxism, and socialism, call it what you like. And soon after that, they started with the open fight, well, skirmishes here and there. I mean, the very first victims were two Serbian gendarmes who were at a gathering where people were celebrating a particular festival in the summer. And they just took them and shot them there and then. This was the big, that, or that, that day they consider is the beginning of their uprising. Well, they didn't kill any Germans. They killed their two innocent people who were just trying to maintain some order. And now you're occupied. If you don't cooperate, you simply have enemies who will come and deal with you much more harshly. In my preparations for this book, I was in touch with the late Sir John, what's his name? He was Churchill's, John Colville. And, I mean, this is to anticipate, but I might just mention it here. He had a leaflet about my book announcing the contents, and he saw something about the British collaboration, and he wrote to me back and said, angrily almost, I was at that time in the war cabinet and, you know, with Churchill, and I would have known about this, and, you know, this is all sort of, you know, fanciful thinking and, you know, just unfounded imagination of somebody who is talking through his heart or other. So I wrote back to him and I said, well, what I'm going to say, Sir John, is not invented. It's all based on British historians. And I gave him chapter and verse, and I mentioned a few people who have written about it, documented. I gave him relevant pages. And I said, well, you can consult these yourself. you can have a look. And he wrote after that, soon after that, and said, well, I must say, I'm amazed. I mean, obviously, a lot of many things happened at that time that we were not aware of. Now, whether he was genuinely saying this, whether he genuinely believed, I find it difficult to accept. But he went on to differentiate. He said, now we got to start differentiating between collaboration and cooperation. So, you see, it was, in one case, this was cooperation. Well, call it what you like. All right. In our case, it was collaboration. The Channel Islands was to be cooperation. Now, I don't see much difference there, because if you are occupied there and those journalists, you know, we had the police before that, and they would simply ask the people working in gas and electricity industries and food industries and the police, you know, to carry on in their jobs, but of course they accept orders from their new masters and to do what they told them. Anyway, these were the two victims. And of course they started organizing them. You see, they had their network all over the country.
These are partisans.
The partisans. Mm. Well, they didn't call themselves partisans at that time. We called them Shumtsi, men from the forest.
How do you spell that?
Well, it's Shumtzi, Shumtzi. That sort of gives you the approximate phonetic pronunciation. And they would appear, you know, here and there and in various places, holding public meetings. Sorry, holding public meetings, carrying out propaganda. Again, it's all for Mother Russia. Mother Russia was one. We are, you know, to help because they are fighting against this German menace and fascist beast and so on. Until yesterday, they were their bosom friends. But still, anyway, people swallowed all that. They came, they threatened people. If they heard that there were some arms or guns stored somewhere, they would come during the night and threatened and get them. So they collected quite a lot of, you know, weapons like this. They started organizing this underground movement. And then, of course, you know, later on, it didn't take very long. This was, you know, June, July, August, September, November. You see, during those 3 or 4 months, a great deal of happened. They became quite strong in many places. And one crafty thing they did, you see, the Chetniks were first organized by Petyanats. He was the traditional Chetnik leader who fought against the Bulgarians during the last war. And so he had very great, you know, very great reputation amongst our people. So many people, you know, who had these Chetnik connections joined him and they started to form in their units. But these were nationalist units. They were for the king and against communism, for the, you know, sort of faith and tradition as against these innovatory doctrines and foreign doctrines coming in the process of being imposed on our people. Unfortunately, some of these people proved to be not very reliable. You know, they were exploiting this particular position for their own good life. So they would come to a place and say, come on, we want so much, you know, fried chicken or pig or plenty of drink, schlewitz and all this, gibanitsa. So they would be, you know, feasting rather than, you know, thinking of some more, you know, not lie on their backs and think of Yugoslavia, but they were really thinking of their tummies. And communists or partisans at that time, they did this clever thing. They knew that some of these people, you know, the local people who were not particularly good characters, and they would more or less encourage them or push them to go and join the Chetniks, which helped to discredit them in a way. But they would go for the most upright and trusted people. I remember in my, for example, neighboring town, Svrljig, there was a very fine doctor, Dr. Hadžić. Honest, upright, man of integrity. You know, I mean, I told you early on that it was a, you know, primitive life, not much by way of comforts, medical services, well, very limited. I mean, you didn't have a doctor, you know, for miles. Anyway, if people came to him at night, any time of the night, day or night, and asked him, he would go with them. He was highly respected. But they managed to convert him to their cause. Now, I'm not sure whether he was a communist himself, but it was people like that who had the great influence on how people decided and which side to join, whether to sympathize more with the Chetniks and Mikhailovich, or with this new group of people calling themselves Shumtsi or national liberators. You see, partisans came later, you see.
It sounds very confusing. It must have been very confusing.
And it was very confusing to ordinary people because, again, you see, they would go for people they trusted. And there was Dr. Hadžić. Absolutely marvelous person.
How about your own situation? What was happening to you as a young man at this time? You mentioned you were down in this sort of area in Bulgaria.
Yes. Well, as you know, I was here in Prizren, you know, a place that's here, well, just on the outskirts by Montenegro there. I managed to get home just, you know, a few days before the invasion. Then, of course, at that time, my father had been killed in an accident. Couple of years before this. My mother wasn't very strong, so I stayed at home for the time being. Well, after all, I felt it was my duty to look. My younger brother and sister were still, you know, very, very, very small and very dependent on others. So I was sort of, you know, the man of the house to provide and to protect them. But of course, I told you, I belong to this movement, Zbor. As I think it started really since the time of the Spanish War, in the early 30s. You know, I remember we had long arguments there because the communists and the Republicans were, you know, so very much, you know, on the Republican side, and we were, you know, I don't think we were sort of in favor of fascism, but we were against that kind of movement. So we were monarchists, and so we had these arguments, you know, going on for months and years. And well, on the 27th of March, on the day of putsch or coup, the situation became so tense in Prizren. I mean, I was there with my colleagues attending these public meetings and listening to speeches and harangues and all this. But I was also threatened with violence, you know, physical violence as one of the leaders from my college. In fact, I didn't dare go out of college unless accompanied by sort of two of the strongest colleagues and my bodyguards, as it were. Otherwise, they would, God knows what would have happened then, because they simply, you know, were intolerant. They hated people who disagreed with them. And so anyway, nothing happened to me. Nothing, as far as I remember. I don't think any of our people was hurt. But you had to be on your guard. So I was a well-known person. I was a marked person, if you like. I had a particular ideology. I had a particular views, which were definitely anti-communist. And in fact, I have been holding, you know, a few speeches here and there, giving a few speeches here and there, and advocating an anti-communist philosophy.